Support for this podcast comes from Esurance, providing insurance shopping tools like real-time comparison quotes and coverage counselors. Learn more at esurance.com.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do intelligence experts and policymakers communicate, and how does their ability to interact honestly and constructively affect the well-being and defense of the United States? These questions are of deep concern to my guest this hour, who has written extensively on the subject, and tomorrow will lead a panel discussion on threats and opportunities for national security. Joshua Rovner is John Goodwin Tower Distinguished Professor of International Politics and National Security, Associate Professor of Political Science at SMU, and Director of Studies at the Tower Center for Political Studies, which today and tomorrow is hosting a conference called Making Strategy Under Budget Austerity, Regional Threats and Practical Responses. Josh, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So it stands to reason that policymakers rely on intelligence provided by intelligence professionals. How is that information shared so that it can guide political decisions?
Yeah, there's a number of different kinds of intelligence that policymakers use. There's everything from very basic intelligence about sort of regular data about countries to current intelligence about what's happening in a country on a day-to-day basis. And then there are strategic estimates, and these are broader, deeper estimates of what the future is going to hold. And those strategic estimates can include anything from a very focused study of, say, Iran's nuclear program to a broader estimate of what the future holds in Europe or in Asia.
So very often when people think intelligence, they think sort of cloak and dagger stuff, but it's more like scholarship than people might realize.
There is a very strong analogy to scholarship. And in fact, in the early days in the CIA and the intelligence community, a lot of their early professionals were drawn from academia and from the Ivy League. They went out and recruited professors to be analysts and to be analytical managers. I wouldn't take the analogy too far. Scholarship relies on transparency. Scholarship relies on an open discussion among scholars and their critics, whereas intelligence is the world of secrets. So there is something to that analogy, but I wouldn't take it too far.
So assuming that everybody's acting in good faith, and maybe we can't always assume that, but for purposes of this discussion, we will. Why have there been such glaring failures over the past decade in particular, most notably with that flawed information that led up to the Iraq War?
I think that the issue of intelligence failure has occupied a lot of attention. And too often, people who've looked at this issue have focused on intelligence agencies' mistakes. Either they don't know how to collect the right information or they don't know how to make use of it. What I found in my book and in my research is very often the problem is a breakdown in intelligence policy relations. Something happens in that connection that causes the intelligence to go awry. So before the Iraq War, just to give you an example of this, the intelligence community had some beliefs about Iraqi capabilities, their chemical weapons, their biological weapons, and so forth. They had assumptions about Iraq which were wrong, but wrong for understandable reasons. Before the war, however, they were very clear about the limits of their knowledge. They said, we really don't have a great picture of what's going on. We have some beliefs about Saddam Hussein. We know he's not a very good guy, but we don't know that much about what's really happening. The problem was that the Bush administration then leaned on the intelligence community very heavily, and they took their worst-case assumptions and made that the mainline position. So it wasn't so much a failure of intelligence so much as a real collapse in intelligence policy relations.
Well, what kind of issue is the variance in tolerance for ambiguity? Because it makes sense that if you are collecting intelligence, you can say these are 9 possible scenarios. If you are the person responsible for making a decision, you want someone to say, number 4 is the one you need to pay attention to.
This is a classic question. This is an enduring problem for intelligence and policymakers alike. Intelligence agencies try to convey useful information to the policy community in such a way that's honest about the limits of knowledge and realistic about uncertainty. On the other hand, if they give too many caveats and too many conditions, it looks like it's just mealy-mouthed. It looks like it's not something that policymakers can use. And very often, policymakers think that they're just protecting their bureaucratic interests because they don't really want to take a stand. So there's been a lot of real soul-searching in the intelligence community for many years on how to overcome this problem. There's no perfect solution. Right? This is just an inherent struggle, especially on issues which are so, so difficult to predict in advance. Things like, when would Iran have a nuclear program? Or when might another terrorist attack occur? It's very hard to make a point estimate on these things. So the trick for intelligence agencies is to craft estimates in such a way that they give policymakers something to work with but don't give them an overrealistic sense of certainty.
But back in 2003, there were intelligence analysts telling policymakers that Iran might have, or Iraq, excuse me, might have a nuclear weapon by, what was it, 2010?
Yeah, well, on that issue, the intelligence estimates on Iraq's nuclear program were actually very vague up to about the summer of 2002. Mm-hmm. The basic consensus, to the extent that there was a consensus, was that Iraq had a nuclear program in the 1980s, that Saddam Hussein was probably interested someday in rebuilding that nuclear program, but that he had a minimal capability after a decade of sanctions and inspections, and that, quite frankly, very little was known about it. That estimate changed dramatically in the autumn of 2002, and it became much more ominous and much more worrisome. And one of the things that puzzled me is that this wasn't because of new information. The intelligence community was changing its analytical conclusions, not really based on new information, but I think because there was real policy pressure to exaggerate the Iraqi threat.
What would the reason for that pressure have been in terms of domestic politics?
Intelligence is a great PR tool. Intelligence agencies control secrets, and secrecy moves people in a way that open information doesn't move people. There's some really fascinating experimental psychology on this, that people treat secret information as more credible and more believable than information that they could otherwise receive. Policymakers know this, right? So that when they publicize intelligence, they can say, we deserve the benefit of the doubt because we have access to secret information, which is closer to the truth, right? So it's a very, very effective PR tool for policymakers to use. But policymakers can go one better with this. Instead of revealing all of the intelligence, you just reveal a little bit, and then you say the rest has to remain classified for security reasons. Hmm. So we'll offer you a taste. We'll show you the tip of the iceberg. We won't show you everything.
And so the tip of the iceberg that we hear, our brains can sort of imagine that there is much, much worse.
Correct.
That would further convince us of the wisdom of a certain decision.
Yeah, the really juicy stuff has to remain classified, is the implicit signal of these sort of intelligence revelations.
But is it your sense that politicians sort of recognize that they are picking and choosing information and trying to deceive the American public, or is it your sense that most political leaders are thinking they are acting objectively?
I think that most political leaders believe that they're right in what they're doing. I believe that the Bush administration clearly believed that Iraq was a threat, but it had a political problem. It had to overcome a great deal of congressional skepticism in the summer of 2002, and some a little bit of public skepticism as well. I mean, recall, this is after 9/11. Most of our focus had been on al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And suddenly the administration is shifting to Iraq. It needed to overcome that skepticism. It needed to convince people that this really was a looming danger and a present threat. And what better way to do that than by releasing some intelligence, showing that this is not some distant danger, but this is really this is a problem right now and it must be dealt with. This is where intelligence was so useful.
And why was it that not much attention was paid to the fact that the UN had not found, had not come to similar conclusions, the IAEA had not come to similar conclusions, both of which have been used in other arguments to sort of demonstrate the validity of a particular position?
The problem in this case was that once intelligence went public in the autumn of 2002, once the intelligence community made a very clear and very ominous judgment about what Iraq had, it had little interest in going back and revisiting those conclusions. Right? So even though international inspectors went back to the country and ran around for several weeks and found evidence of nothing, there was just no real incentive for the intelligence community to revisit its earlier findings, because to do so would constitute a very frank and public admission of failure. That is, we got it wrong before, so sorry. They were not going to do that. And this is, in the book and in my broader research, this is why I say that this is one of the real reasons that you want to keep intelligence estimates out of the public eye, because it inhibits reassessment. It takes away the possibility for intelligence agencies to go back and candidly and quietly say, we got that wrong.
Yeah, because then suddenly everything they do is called into question, and Correct. They're having to fight those fires rather than focusing on the task at hand.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. What's to be done in situations where intelligence experts simply can't answer a question that is important to policymakers?
Well, if there really is no answer, if there's no uncertainty, they have to be honest about that. Better to be honest about what you don't know than to make something up just to stay involved in the conversation. There are some who have argued that intelligence officials need to, if not pander to policymakers, at least give them a little bit of what they like in order to stay relevant, and in order to stay relevant to the policy process. I think that's very dangerous. I think that sets intelligence agencies up for real failure and bigger breakdowns later.
My guest is Joshua Rovner. He is John Goodwin Tower Distinguished Professor of International Politics and National Security. The Tower Center is holding its annual National Security Conference today and tomorrow on the SMU campus. The title is Making Strategy Under Budget Austerity, Regional Threats and Practical Responses. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. You're invited to join us by going online to kera.org or calling in to 1-800-933-5372. As we take this quick break, I am joined now by Think producer Stephen Becker. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Chris. Very interesting discussion this hour. Just the same type of very informative and, thought-provoking discussion we have every hour here on Think. Want to get to a really quick piece of information, and that's that, of course, we're during our fall membership campaign. And we got another one of those iPads. We know people love iPads. And we're going to have a drawing for an iPad today at 7 o'clock. So if you get your contribution in between now and 7, you'll be entered in.
Make it now, and you don't have to wait that long to find out if you win. I always like that, not having to wait, 6 weeks or something. You'll know by the end of the day, and wouldn't that be a nice perk as you're driving home on a rainy afternoon? We're looking for 40 calls this hour, contributions in any amount. And when we say calls, we also mean online contributions at kera.org. We have 7 so far. We can certainly pick up the pace on this if you will make your contribution. You can also call 888-694-6931. Make your contribution. We will sign you up for the drawing. And if you are interested in a thank you gift that we have mentioned today or any other day, ask about it on the phone or check it out online. Most of them are indeed still available.
Yeah, and when you mention online, I think it's also worth noting that when you make your contribution, you're paying not only for the radio broadcast that goes out over the airwaves, but you're paying for things like KERA.org and KERANews.org, where maybe you listen to our live stream, or maybe you check on the news throughout the day on KERANews.org, and then you sprint out to your car and hop in there and tune it to 90.1. That also is what, your contributions go to pay for, is bringing you the news wherever you are and wherever you would like to consume it.
And I always think that the money that you contribute also pays for making your time remarkably more productive, so that if you are listening to us over the air or you are listening via podcast, time that you might otherwise feel was wasted when you're commuting or when you were just sitting at lunch or when you're, ferrying the kids around or you're just sitting at home, but you're also taking care of some other things. Your brain is active the whole time. You're learning interesting things. You're exploring ideas. You're hearing diverse perspectives on pretty much everything under the sun. That's a value that we know is really important to many of you who consider yourselves lifelong learners. Make a contribution now to be one of the people who creates this in North Texas.
Yeah, it only takes just a second, and I promise you that you will feel good about doing your part to bring public radio to North Texas, not only to yourself, but to people all across our listening area. We've got lots of thank you gifts again online at kera.org, which is where you can make your contribution.
You can also call in to 888-694-6931. There are plenty of folks on the phones to take your call, but an online contribution works just as well, and you can check out thank you gifts there also. Again, kera.org or 888-694-6931. Back in 2 minutes with Joshua Roker.
We'll be right back. Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Joshua Rovner, who is John Goodwin Tower Distinguished Professor of International Politics and National Security, Associate Professor of Political Science, and Director of Studies at the Tower Center for Political Studies, which today and tomorrow is presenting its National Security Conference called Making Strategy Under Budget Austerity, Regional Threats and Practical Responses. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Josh, what kind of political pressure filters down to intelligence professionals who I think are trained that they are supposed to be objective regardless? How is it that they end up feeling susceptible to political pressure?
There are a number of ways that this happens. There are instances of direct pressure, which is real elbow twisting, where policymakers really lean on some intelligence chiefs to try to get them on board and to try to agree with their own views in public. More commonly, you have a kind of indirect pressure, which leads to a kind of politicization of intelligence, which is more subtle. What happens in these cases is that policymakers send signals to the intelligence community about the kind of estimates that they want to see, about the kind of conclusions they want to hear. And they can do this through a lot of ways. They can ask repeated questions, the same question over and over and over again, until intelligence analysts who are not dumb people get the message.
Right.
They get the message. Policymakers can also elevate certain analysts and give them access and give them opportunities to speak at high levels in the policymaker circle, which sends a signal to the rest of the intelligence community that if you want that kind of access to policy, if you want that kind of prestige, you should also adopt these views. This is more insidious, this kind of indirect pressure, because it's very, very hard to deal with. Policymakers very often, if they're accused of this, will say, we've done nothing wrong. Mm-hmm. We were simply asking hard questions of our intelligence services, and if we weren't asking those questions, we wouldn't be doing their jobs. There's truth in this. So it's difficult to find the line between proper questioning and a proper dialogue between intelligence policy and improper pressure, which is going too far and trying to mold intelligence or, as I say, fix the facts to meet the policy.
Are the intelligence services in this country sort of training their analysts to resist pressure?
There's been a lot of activity within the intelligence community to deal with this and to build it in some way into the curriculum of education that they receive. I don't know exactly what they are saying in the classrooms. Obviously, that's classified. But I know that it is an issue which is receiving a lot of attention. How do you deal with policymakers? If something happens untoward, how do you deal with it? There are formal structures that have been set up, like ombudsman and so forth, so that if analysts feel like they are under pressure or if something is wrong in this relationship, they have an outlet.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Chip in Corsicana. Hi, Chip.
Hi. We actually kind of halfway answered my question, but if the politicians in the administration, whatever administration that these guys are talking to, has the ability to browbeat or pressure them into packaging the intelligence so it fits whatever round hole cake that they're trying to make it fit, to use the example of the Bush administration not saying, and, you know, suddenly we're in a war that we really didn't need to be into.
You know what, Chip? I'm so sorry. Your call is breaking up. I think you wanted to ask about the effect of that pressure on the efficiency of the system as a whole in that communication. Maybe you can, I hope I'm assuming correctly, but maybe you can speak to that, Josh.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't hear the rest of the question either. It does have lasting consequences. When you have episodes of politicization, of political pressure, it really does make the system much less inefficient and ineffective over the long term. And what happens typically in these cases is that mutual stereotypes get reinforced. policymakers increasingly look at intelligence officials as obstacles to implementing their policy, and intelligence officials look at policymakers as meddling bullies. Right? These bad feelings can persist for years and years after the fact, and this is one reason why this is so dangerous.
How would you categorize healthy tension between those two areas of expertise, and at what point does healthy tension turn toxic?
Yeah, a good intelligence policy relation does rely on healthy tension, right? Policymakers need to have the ability to ask hard questions of intelligence without being accused of politicization, and intelligence officials need to be able to deliver uncomfortable news without being accused of trying to undermine policy interest. This is always going to be difficult. There's inherent tension built into the system, and there's no way to resolve it completely. But when it's worked best, typically, is when these conversations in this dialogue is held in secret. As soon as these estimates become public, as soon as they enter the political fray, it's very, very hard to make that healthy tension persist. And it's really easy to see the relationship break down.
So to the extent that the buildup to the Iraq war was based perhaps on some faulty intelligence or on what many people agree today was faulty intelligence, and that some of that was faulty because it took worst case scenarios instead of maybe something more down the line. I mean, how much do you think that was caused by the failure of 9/11, the failure of prediction of 9/11 and prevention of it, and the sense maybe within intelligence agencies that it's safer to take the worst case scenario position?
That might explain part of it. Certainly the intelligence community had been burned prior to this case. After the first Gulf War, there was a wide sense that the intelligence community had missed some important things about what was going on in Iraq in the 1980s, specifically Iraq's nuclear program, which was much more dispersed and larger than intelligence officials had thought. And then they also felt very much so on the defensive after 9/11, when they were being accused of a total failure of intelligence. And they even had some people wondering why we needed intelligence community if it couldn't do this simple thing. So I think that that was playing into the estimates a little bit. On the other hand, that doesn't explain the dramatic shift in the content and the tone of estimates in the summer of 2002. All the way up to that point, the intelligence community had been pretty steadfast in their core beliefs about Iraq, that, again, it was a very odious regime. Saddam Hussein had very bad intentions, but given what we knew, he didn't have anything like a biological program or a chemical weapons program or a nuclear program that we should be afraid of in any way. It's just something to watch and something to monitor. And then suddenly, in the late summer and fall, they get very, very worried. That I can't attribute that simply to 9/11 or simply to the experience of being burned in the past.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Vid in Dallas. Hi, Vid.
Hi. Very interesting conversation, and thanks for your thoughts here. The question I had was building on the comment you made about, you know, how at a certain point the intelligence agencies or the organization itself moved to a point where they could not go back and say that, you know, what they had said in the past was wrong. And your latest comments seem to be also saying that there was a sudden shift at a certain point, right? So if I see this as a failure as an organizational failure, as in, let's say, a business organization suddenly is competitive, but at a certain point starts to make decisions which are uncompetitive, you know, in those situations, there are controls by the marketplace, or there are controls by, you know, say, the whistleblower program. Are there any such controls possible when it comes to intelligence where, you know, you have a sudden shift and, you know, what was said in the past has to be negated but cannot be done because the organization is in this inertia of movement and you just cannot go back? How do you address that?
Thanks for your call.
That's a terrific question. There are mechanisms within the intelligence community to prevent this. And one of the more important ones is a very, very careful review of any estimate which seems to be a stark difference from past ones. There's a lot of introspection about why are we making this new judgment right now? Do we have new information which is forcing us to change our position? Are we analyzing it in a different way? Why are we arriving at this conclusion now? And there are a lot of internal mechanisms in which they essentially compete over estimates, and they have ways of testing each other's theories internally. for my money, the best way to prevent this from happening, these sudden unexplained shifts in intelligence, is to restore a moratorium on making these things public. I really do believe that strategic estimates typically can adjust appropriately if they're done in secret. But once you bring them into public, you invite a lot of very nasty bureaucratic politics and very nasty partisan politics, which makes it hard for the intelligence community to alter its conclusions.
Of course, as a journalist, I have to wonder, when you leave too much secret, are you then allowing sort of potentially a cabal of intelligence professionals and political leaders to make decisions based on a lot of information that the American public doesn't have the chance to really look over and approve?
Yeah, this is a fundamental question, right? Because secrecy and democracy always exist in tension. These things are in some sense incompatible, right? And yet, they have lived together for a long, long time. The intelligence community was born, the modern intelligence community was born in 1947, about the same time that the United States started leading the modern international order. So as the United States spent a half century and counting on expanding our kind of liberal order, we've also expanded this secret intelligence community. So it is possible to have these things working in parallel. The other thing is, on big foreign policy issues, the decision to go to war, the decision to not go to war, or other very consequential decisions, the public has a lot of ways of assessing the wisdom of policy judgments. The public doesn't have to rely on declassified intelligence. You can make reasonable decisions about something like Syria or something like Egypt or whatever based on your reading of the news. We're certainly not short of information as a public these days. In fact, I think we might be overwhelmed by it.
Should we have concerns about the outsourcing of some intelligence functions to private corporations?
I think in general we should. I wouldn't take it too far, because a lot of what is outsourced is necessary work that can be done very well by private contractors. The problem with outsourcing is that you lose a chain of command, mm-hmm. right? If a contractor is involved in intelligence and something goes wrong or they need to come back, they don't have to. Like, they can bail. Whereas people who work for the intelligence community, they can't simply bail. They're vested in it. So I'm a little bit nervous about that. And the intelligence community, like a lot of the government, is deeply reliant on contractors at this point. So I think this does deserve a lot of attention.
Joshua Rovner is my guest. He is John Goodwin Tower Distinguished Professor of International Politics and National Security. The Tower Center is having its National Security Conference today and tomorrow on the SMU campus. The title of that conference is Making Strategy Under Budget Austerity, Regional Threats and Practical Responses. Join the conversation at 800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We're taking yet another little break here. Stephen Becker, producer of Think, is back in the room. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Chris. It's always nice when you get a new friend, and we got a new friend during that last break. If you're unfamiliar with the way the Friends of KERA works, basically, if you are in a position where you can make a contribution of $1,500 or more, you will join the Friends of KERA. And that's really the, you know, kind of the backbone of support we have from listeners. A lot of it comes from friends of the station. So if you are able to support the station at that level, we'd certainly love to give you more information about that. There's a whole page about it at kera.org. Or I know that somebody would love to tell you all about it at 888-694-6931.
Yeah, there are some special advantages that come along with being a friend, including getting to meet a lot of the individuals who come from PBS, from NPR, come visit us for special events. Those events are often invitations are made available to our friends level members. But listen, I'm not in a position to be a friends member. I don't think you are either, Stephen, but our contributions still matter, you know, at whatever level. $5 or $10 or $20 or $50 a month really adds up for the station and can be very affordable when you set up this sustaining membership so that you only miss $5 or $10 or $20 or whatever dollars a month. So take action now at 888-694-6931 or kera.org.
Yeah, and that sustaining membership, for my purposes, really is the way to go, because I'm someone who maybe is not going to remember every month or every drive, you know, that I need to make my contribution. But when you have it set up on your sustaining membership, you just tell your bank or your credit card, you know, how much you'd like taken out every month. And then if you happen to remember, the nice thing is you see that it, you know, turned over to the first of the month and you say, oh, you know, I made my contribution to KERA and I didn't even have to do anything to do it. It's really simple. And if you want to, again, just, you know, have a sustained membership, it's called sustaining member for a reason. That's a simple way to set it up.
If you have not yet added KERA to your list of organizations for charitable giving, you know, you might be saying to yourself, look, I love KERA, but I can't give to everybody. And we totally understand that. But the thing is, this is an organization that you use, whose services you consume on a daily and for some of us an hourly basis. This is an organization that you not only can help, but that you rely on yourself to receive quality information, to have interesting ideas presented to you without a political spin. I hope that you never turn on Think and assume that I'm trying to convince you of anything, because I, like you, I'm just trying to sort of understand the world around me and how people arrive at their conclusions. We think this is worth paying for, and we are here for you every day. And we ask you a couple times a year to consider making a contribution at KERA.org.
Chris, we have a goal of 40 calls this hour. It looks like we've heard from 13 folks so far. Some of those people who have already helped us out today are Karen Swenson in Dallas, Shelley Tatum in Dallas, Lois Weeks in Fort Worth, and Julie Burson in Denton. They took just a moment out of what I'm sure is a very busy day, just like we all have busy days, to make their contribution online at KERA.org. or by calling 888-694-6931. A couple of other quick thanks go to Seth and Catherine Kaplan of Dallas, William and June Peterson of Keller, Jane and Dick Buck of Richardson, and Seth and Catherine Kaplan again of Dallas. I'm not sure if that's a second contribution or we just got...
Either way, thank you.
Either way, we thank each of you doubly if we had the time to do that.
You know, one reason that a lot of you tell us you like the show is that you're never quite sure what you're going to get. I was looking over the schedule for the week, and it's interesting that this hour we have Joshua Rovner, John Goodwin Tower, Distinguished Professor of International Politics, National Security. Tomorrow at this hour, we're talking about candy and how we have vilified candy in our culture. Both are really, I think, interesting shows. I'm excited about both of them. Obviously, one is ongoing as we speak. The ability to sort of consider the world broadly is something that NPR really does well, and that we at KERA try to do well for you here in North Texas. We exist because of the contributions of regular people like you and me who think this is important. So please consider making your contribution now at KERA.org or 888-694-6931. Back in 2 minutes with Joshua Rovner.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Joshua Rovner, who is Associate Professor of Political Science at SMU and Director of Studies at the Tower Center for Political Studies. The Tower Center's National Security Conference, Making Strategy Under Budget Austerity, Regional Threats and Practical Responses, is ongoing today and tomorrow on the SMU campus. If you want to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So do you expect, Josh, that the current outrage over U.S. surveillance of, among others, allied leaders, allies of the United States, will have any change, or is this just something everybody talks about in public that will continue in private?
I think that the anger among European leaders right now is real. I think the anger in European publics, if you read their media, does seem palpable and real. The question is, how long does it last? Right. All these countries have long been involved in espionage, even against some of their friends. So there's a bit of shocked indignation that is a little hard to fathom, that they know this is going on to some extent. That said, if you turned the tables, if we found out that German intelligence had been listening to President Obama's cell phone for the last decade, there might be a little bit of unrest here as well. I think that more broadly, this will pass. I think that that states understand that there is espionage. There's reason that they even sometimes will conduct it against each other. And I look at the history of U.S. and German relations and U.S. and French relations, and I see much bigger past crises. Right? Much. The Iraq War was a huge crisis of U.S.-German relations, and we overcame that. There were huge crises in the 1980s, and we overcame those as well. This, I think, won't last too long.
I'm aware that your academic focus is not diplomacy, but do you have any sense of how different the conversations are behind closed doors between leaders of these countries, say between President Obama and Angela Merkel?
I think that they probably are a bit different. And again, it's the same idea that we were discussing in the first part of this show, that when you have closed-door conversations, which are not in public, when you're not standing behind a podium and in front of a battery of microphones and cameras, you can be much more candid. And I understand that President Obama and Chancellor Merkel do have a long relationship. I would imagine that the closed-door conversations are a lot friendlier than the open public accusations and upset that we're hearing right now. So it's much as in the same way as we were speaking about before. If you have confidentiality, if you have some degree of secrecy, that encourages candor. It's much like doctor-patient confidentiality or attorney-client privilege. Much as if you want intelligence to be accurate, you have to keep it secret so they can have a candid conversation. I think the same is true in diplomatic circles. You need to have the presumption that diplomacy can be conducted, at least in some cases, in private. Now, this gets to a bigger ongoing issue, which is the revelations that come out of Edward Snowden and before him, Bradley Manning. There is some consternation among diplomats right now that their private conversations will be revealed, not necessarily by Edward Snowden, but that they will somehow end up on WikiLeaks. And that will be deeply embarrassing, and that will inhibit them from having the sort of frank conversations with Americans that they otherwise would have. That might be a real danger.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Doug on the line now in Rockwall. Hi, Doug.
Yes. Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
Well, Chris, I don't know Dr. Rogner as well, but I've listened to you for years. You could have made it just fine in drama. You have excellent diction and articulation of your words.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
I wanted to ask a question, Dr. Rogner. I just reread Thomas Friedman's The World is Flat. I'm sure you're familiar with the book. It was published in 2005. He updated it in 2007. In there, he speaks about this cataclysmic change we have in society where we don't just have consumers of information like we did in earlier administrations. With the early 90s, now we have bloggers and we have producers of information. And this goes back to the comment you made just a few seconds ago about secrecy. To the extent that we have so many producers of independent information, how is that affecting keeping things secret, say, compared to even 15 or 20 years ago?
Thanks for your call.
Terrific question. It makes things, in some senses, more difficult because it's so much easier to share information publicly than it ever was. You have a situation in which somebody like Bradley Manning can walk out of a facility with a CD and reveal a great deal of information. On the other hand, the fact that so much information is being produced also increases the chances that those kind of leaks will mostly be irrelevant noise, right? If you have just an incredible amount of information, even if you have high-scale leaks, it doesn't necessarily mean that important secrets will be revealed.
Talk a little bit about the conference and why the focus is this climate of austerity that exists all around the world right now.
Yeah, it's thanks for the question. It's a conference about how do you make strategy when budgets are getting tight. And the inspiration for the conference was that for the last dozen or so years, the Defense Department has been flush. Right? It's staggering rise in defense spending after 9/11, which has just been going gangbusters. And even the current budget request is upwards of $600 billion when you include funding for Afghanistan. It's even higher than that if you include other kinds of funding for VA programs and so forth. But that number is going to come down. The money is going to start to go away. And it's all going to fall on, or not all of it, but a lot of the cuts are going to fall on things like new weapons buying and readiness rates, because most of the rise in defense spending has been related to military compensation and healthcare spending. And no politician wants to attack those issues, right? So military officers, policymakers are going to have to deal with a situation in which they're making strategy with declining budgets, and they have a very finite amount of resources that they can spend on new weapons and where to send them. So that's what we're going to be trying to wrestle with over the next 2 days.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, we've discussed on this show before the fact that for a long time, American national security was very much focused on sort of Cold War era threats, and then those went away. And while it would be a gross misstatement to say that everybody, that nobody predicted that we would have the kinds of problems we do now, they weren't the focus. And it's hard to sort of know what's coming up in the future. I mean, how much credence do we give to predictions about where the next conflict site might be and what we might need to stay safe through it?
It's very hard to do, to do this exercise of scanning the horizon and looking for the new kind of threat or the new danger that might affect American national security. It's understandable why we walk through this exercise and do this constant scanning and looking for the next new thing, that there is a real danger in that kind of approach, which is that you can take it too far. If you're constantly on the lookout for new security threats, you may simply come to assume that you are insecure, and you might miss important signs that, in fact, we are secure, and we're very secure as a country. So what we're going to be wrestling with in this conference is how do you assess possible security threats without going too far, without exaggerating, without looking for phantoms, looking for monsters to destroy when those monsters really might not exist.
So in other words, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail if you're not careful.
That's true. Yeah. If you view things in terms of national security threats and they deserve a military response, you're in for some very bad strategy, and it becomes impossible to set priorities at that time.
So is it healthy to have to ask ourselves if the levels of spending we have done are appropriate?
Oh, always. Always. We should always have a very public conversation, not just because we're dealing with hundreds of billions of dollars. This is a huge level of investment in national security. But we need to be discussing whether or not we're allocating all of this money in the right ways. And there's two ways that you can have this conversation. One is, as we just discussed, looking into the future, scanning for new threats. Are we apportioning money and resources in the right direction? Should we be, for instance, moving from the Middle East to East Asia, pivoting towards China? I think another equally useful way of doing this is to look to our own past and to assess the results of our recent strategic decisions, both in the 1990s and in the last decade, and not just harp on failures, not just say, wow, we really screwed up here and we really, really messed up there, but appreciate some important success stories. Right? Appreciate some important success stories. We're actually doing quite well in some pretty important ways. We've made incredible headway against Al-Qaeda, for instance. You wouldn't necessarily know this listening to the news all the time because Al-Qaeda attacks seem to be a constant news story. But actually, we've done great work against Al-Qaeda. The organization that existed in the 1990s, led by Osama bin Laden, was unique and peculiar. It was rich. It was really well organized. It was led by charismatic leaders. It's now gone. That old organization that had the capacity for spectacular violence against Americans is now shattered. And what we have now is this strange hodgepodge of groups all over the place who may or may not have a real link to Al-Qaeda but wave the flag anyways. To me, this is a success story. Right? And recognizing your past successes can help you make better budgetary decisions about how much to invest in things like counterterrorism. So as we're going through this exercise of figuring out how to deal with a range of strategic problems with less resources at hand, it helps not just to look towards the future, but to do a careful reassessment of the past, and not just the things that we did badly, but the things that we also did well.
Joshua Rovner is John Goodwin Tower Distinguished Professor of International Politics and National Security, Associate Professor of Political Science, and Director of Studies at the Tower Center for Political Studies, which is holding its National Security Conference today and tomorrow. It's called Making Strategy Under Budget Austerity, Regional Threats and Practical Responses. Josh, it's been such a great hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks to all of you who are listening today. Really appreciate your participation in the show. We especially appreciate those of you who have made contributions to KERA in the last few minutes, last hour. Thanks to Lisa Wiley in Dallas and G.L. Seligman in Denton. Thank you to Jeanette Berg in Dallas and Dana Orr and Terrence Kennedy in Fort Worth. Really, really appreciate you taking action in support of KERA. You can join these good folks by going online to kera.org or calling 888-694-6931. Stephen Becker is back in with us now. Hi, Stephen.
Chris, I was just thinking, listening to that last hour of conversation, how nice it is to be able to delve deeply into a topic. You know, so often, if you're watching cable news or even regular news, you know, those folks do a good job, but they're very limited by having these very short segments that they've got to kind of hit all the highlights and get out. And I feel like what we're able to do on our show is meander a little bit. And I mean that in the best way. You know, we can see which direction the conversation is going and not just hit the talking points. And it ends up, you know, by the end of the hour, I feel like we've really hopefully given a well-rounded view of the particular topic of the day.
Yeah, I always like conversations with people like Josh Rovner, who can say, here's what I think. But then if you bring up another point, he'll say that absolutely is valid and explain sort of his perspective on that. Sometimes I have guests on the show who are strongly opinionated about their fields of expertise, but we do always expect them to sort of look at problems from a variety of different angles. And we're proud on the days that we succeed with that. We know that you value it. We know that you know that listening to the show over a matter of months, you will hear a variety of different opinions and ideas about a variety of different topics. And each time, what it does is really enhance your understanding of the world. We are never here to answer a question once and for all and consider it solved. We are here to explore ideas together. Some people don't want that, and there are plenty of other radio stations for them to go if that is not something that you value. But you do. You tune to this show. You tune to the station throughout the rest of the day because this kind of exploration of ideas is important to you. This kind of considerate approach to journalism and to information. You can support this by going online and making a contribution at kera.org. Right now, we are just taking web contributions, so you may know the phone number, but if you're ready to make your contribution now, we would ask that for the next few minutes, you do so online.
You know, getting back to your idea about guests, I mean, if I might pat us on the back just a bit here, you know, we don't draw these guest names out of a hat and have them on the show. I mean, we really thoroughly consider what would this person have to say. Are they going to be someone who is just, has one really hardline opinion on something and is inflexible. We like someone who's willing to have a conversation with us, you know, who is not, again, just going to come in here and fire off their talking points and almost like not listen to anyone else. And, you know, our guests know when they come on the show that they're going to get questions from listeners, either through email or over the phones, and they're willing to engage our listeners with, their questions. And I like to think that's one of the real highlights of the show as well. You know, how many other shows out there are you able to connect directly with someone who is either an expert on the topic or, you know, yesterday we had Anne Rice, one of the most famous novelists on earth, who was very happy to engage with people about questions about writing and her books and history. You know, that's what we like to do around here is have guests, again, that are going to be appreciative of the intelligence of our audience.
I think an intelligent conversation will always matter to a certain kind of person. And I think that the public radio person is exactly someone who values that. And one thing that's interesting, you know, we often sort of make the distinction between what we do here and what our colleagues do in commercially supported media. And they do very good work. We never want to come across as being disrespectful of some very fine journalism being done elsewhere. But I will say this, because of the way public radio is funded, because of the way you pay for KERA, we're not required to do things that are sensational and shocking just to guarantee that we have the largest possible number of ears listening at any moment, hoping that something really titillating will happen. That can be okay, but it does get in the way of having a substantive conversation because you want to change ideas every 30 seconds and you want to move on and you want to sort of throw at whatever sticks to the wall. With a show like Think, your contributions, your support, your listening to the show allows us to sort of let ideas breathe and turn them over and explore them and go in a direction we didn't expect. That's because we are not under this sort of pressure to deliver the most gigantic possible audience for the sake of commercial advertisers.
Yeah, we are a bit freed from the if it bleeds, it leads mentality.
Right.
You know, we can break away from that kind of news, which is important news, but is not really the news that we're focused as much on. You mentioned some of our intelligent listeners earlier, and I'd like to thank some of them very quickly before the break. Thanks to Kelly Elenich in McKinney, Mark Wagner in Argyle, Hillary Hudgens in Dallas, and Tracy Holmes. Please join them by making a contribution when you have a chance today at KERA.org.
Thank you also to Adam Martin in Southlake, Beverly Pitchford in Dallas, Judy McDonald in Plano, and Lois Land in Watauga. They all went online to KERA.org, and we hope that you will do so yourself right now. Thanks.